Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Zoom. What's a Zoom room? It's what your conference room is meant to be. With flawless video and audio conferencing, instant wireless content sharing from any device, and just one tap of a button to start a meeting. Any space can easily become a modern, simple-to-use Zoom room. From tiny huddle rooms to executive offices to huge training rooms. And Zoom Rooms is effortlessly scalable, from a few rooms to a few thousand. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial of Zoom Rooms and meet happy with Zoom.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 7th of December, these are our main stories. President Trump says the Saudi king has expressed his condolences after a Saudi aviation trainee shot dead three people at a military base in Florida. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn have gone head-to-head in their final televised debate before next week's general election. Also in this podcast, Lebanon calls on nations to help pay for imports of food and raw materials. How did it come to this?
It's been really scary. We had the importers of medical supplies a couple of days ago warn that they may soon, see people start to die because of the shortages.
And a class action in the US.
I love my daddy.
I love
my daddy so much.
That's the boy who invited all his kindergarten friends to witness his adoption. But we begin in the United States, where officials say that a gunman who killed three people at a military base in Florida before being shot dead was an aviation student from Saudi Arabia. The base commanding officer, Timothy Kinsella, told reporters he'd been humbled by the acts of bravery by those who tried to stop the shooting or help victims.
I am absolutely in awe of the response by our sailors, by our civilian DOD, and by the Escambia County Sheriff's Department. There was some real heroism today. I mean real heroism. I'm devastated. We are in shock. This is surreal. But I couldn't be prouder to wear the uniform that I wear because of my brothers and sisters in uniform, civilian or otherwise, that did what they did today to save lives.
More from our Washington correspondent, Chris Buckler.
This was an individual armed with a handgun on a US military base. Now, it should be pointed out that individuals who go onto these bases, they aren't normally allowed to carry weapons unless it's part of their daily duties. Somehow, this individual managed to get access to a handgun. And certainly by the time sheriff's deputies got there, he had managed to kill three people and wound eight others. And although he was shot dead, you can imagine the investigation is just beginning into exactly what happened here. We do know that he was a Saudi aviation trainee, but at the same time, there seems to be a lot of information that is still being gathered. And clearly, in this investigation, there is an attempt to try and find out exactly what the motive for this attack was.
Now, we're hearing that the Saudi king has already offered his condolences to the people who lost their lives. Obviously, it's very important because Saudi Arabia is a military ally of the United States.
A very important ally, and it is worth pointing out that there have been tensions between the countries, not least since the killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, which is something that continues to cause friction between relationship and the country. Although President Trump has always done his best to try and maintain a very good relationship with the government of Saudi Arabia, and certainly King Salman, in the conversation that President Trump said he had with him, was offering his condolences to the families of the victims, and also saying that the Saudi people were greatly angered by the barbaric actions of the shooter. Bear in mind, those relationships are very, very important, and it's something that King Salman will want to try and retain. But there is a certain amount of anger about this. So it's worth reflecting that the Republican governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, said he expects Saudi Arabia to cooperate fully within any investigation. But beyond that, he also said he thinks they owe a debt to the families of those people who have died, given that this was someone who was working for them, a foreign national in the employ of a foreign service.
Chris Buckler. The Lebanese capital, Beirut, used to be known as the Paris of the Middle East. But in recent years, both the city and the country have slipped a long way since then. Now, the Prime Minister, Saad al-Hariri, has asked foreign allies for help importing food and raw materials. It comes after weeks of political and economic turmoil following months of protest. Alan Johnston is our Middle East analyst.
Lebanon is a country now in very deep economic trouble. And you're right, this is a crisis that has been years in the making. There's been rampant corruption and dire mismanagement of the nation's finances. Lebanon is now being crushed by a great mountain of debt. It's actually one of the world's most indebted nations. More than a third of young Lebanese people are out of work, and now many businesses are laying off more workers. And as the crisis has deepened, banks have imposed controls on the flows of capital. This has led to a serious shortage of dollars, which has meant it's harder for traders to pay for imports. And so you've seen this quite dramatic appeal today by the Lebanese, appealing to support from friendly countries like France, the US, Saudi Arabia. Prime Minister Hariri hoping that they might provide lines of credit which will make it possible for Lebanon to keep on importing basic things, not least food.
You mentioned that individually people are really struggling. I spoke to a journalist, Timur Azari, who lives in Beirut.
If you're an average family in Lebanon right now, chances are that, you know, in the past month or two, you haven't been paid a full wage or you've been laid off from work. And this is sort of, you know, economic conditions that pre-existed the current uprising that we're seeing really coming to the fore now. And so, yeah, you've either, you know, you may have been laid off from work, you may have been paid half a wage or not paid at all. Then if you take your meager earnings to the shop, you'll have seen that prices have gone up 10, 20, 30%, depending on what you're buying. So vegetable prices have gone up 20 to 25%. These are statistics based on surveys of shops, not official government statistics. You might have had trouble getting around in the streets because petrol stations have been on strike repeatedly. This is before the uprising that began 50 days ago and also during it. And the root of that is basically a dollar shortage in the country that has made it very difficult for those who import goods from outside to actually, you know, import those goods. So you're really seeing all of these factors coming together. Now, if you have a loved one or if you yourself need to go to the hospital, you may have encountered a shortage of medical supplies because, medical supply importers have also been dealing with this crisis.
So, Alan, pretty dire situation for many people there. How does this get resolved economically and politically?
Well, the appalling economic situation sparked weeks of anti-government demonstrations. They forced the resignation of Prime Minister Hariri. It looks like the big parties are now beginning to coalesce around a replacement, a man called Samir Khatib, and we may well see him appointed next week. That would break the current political paralysis. But how effective will the new government be as it attempts to confront the great sea of problems that Lebanon faces? And how ready will the protesters be to accept the new government? They've been calling for a great sweeping away of the entire political establishment, a sweeping away of the same parties that are about to put the new government into power.
Alan Johnston, and we also heard from Timur Azari. It's a case that's put the International Criminal Court on a collision course with President Donald Trump's administration. The ICC prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, is trying to get judges to overturn a decision preventing her from opening an investigation into alleged war crimes committed by US troops in Afghanistan. President Trump called the initial rejection of her request a major international victory and denounced the ICC for its broad, unaccountable prosecutorial powers. Friday was the final day of appeals hearings, the last chance to have that ruling reversed, as Anna Holligan reports.
In a slightly surreal moment,
we'll be cramping.
We're cramming into an elevator with the US President Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Jay Sekulow, and his burly security detail. Why did you come here to represent the U.S.?
They've specifically targeted U.S. soldiers and also intelligence officers, meaning the CIA. But this, I mean, look, there's no doubt about it. This is a direct move by the prosecutor on U.S. interests. There's no question about that. I think it'd be naive to think that's not the case. They've said it.
In 2018, his boss, President Trump, told the United Nations General Assembly,
As far as America is concerned, the ICC has no jurisdiction, no legitimacy, and no authority. We will never surrender America's sovereignty to an unelected, unaccountable global bureaucracy.
Of course, the prosecutor and all 18 judges of the court are elected by its member states. And Mr. Sekulow wouldn't respond to any questions about the US administration putting political pressure on the court by revoking the ICC prosecutor's US visa and threatening additional sanctions if the ICC tried to investigate any US citizens.
I'm not going to get into what the State Department made a determination to do or not do with regard to visas.
Is the president watching?
I don't think so.
President Trump might need to tune in if the appeals judges decide the prosecutor should be allowed to investigate U.S. troops in Afghanistan, as the Afghan human rights activist Horia Mostiq is urging them to. Her message to the court and the countries that created it is clear.
Do not bow to the bullies, because we know that U.S. is bullying the court, but you are 123 countries and you have to be strong and you have to have the gut to stand against the bullies. Don't let the court to come to its knees, because very powerful countries in Europe, like United Kingdom, like Germany, like France, they should have the gut to stand and support the court, to support the legitimacy of the court. They can't just give up and walk away and turn their back.
A 2016 report from the ICC found evidence that US soldiers had tortured at least 61 detainees in Afghanistan and at secret CIA interrogation black sites in Poland, Russia and Lithuania. Despite this, the judges decided there was no point in granting the prosecutor's request to investigate because the lack of cooperation from the US meant so little hope of prosecution. A stunning decision, says Mark Kirsten, the author of Justice in Conflict.
To basically say that it's not in the interests of justice to pursue justice was a gobsmacking insult to victims, survivors, and frankly to people elsewhere around the world who, you know, have a degree of faith that someone's at some point, sometime will deliver a degree of accountability or at least stand in their corner.
The ICC report also alleged that the Afghan government and the Taliban had committed war crimes. Afghanistan's lawyers told the judges they want to conduct the investigations domestically. It will be months before the appeals judges decide how best to serve the interests of justice and whether to allow the prosecutor to take on what's already one of the most high-profile and politically charged cases in the International Criminal Court's short history.
Anna Holligan reporting. By next year, according to the British Council, 2 billion people will be speaking or learning English worldwide. The problem, though, is there simply aren't enough English language teachers to teach all these people. However, technology may offer a solution. Early next year, Waverly Labs, a US tech company, is going to release a set of earphones that can translate foreign languages within 1.5 seconds, as my colleague Kizzy Cox found out.
Hi.
Kizzy?
Yes, yes.
Hi, nice to meet you, Andrew.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, this is George, hello. By the way.
At his office in an old Navy base in Brooklyn, I met Andrew Ochoa, CEO of Waverly Labs and the creator of the Ambassador Interpreter earphones.
It's a very nice space.
Yeah, I used to build the battleship engines here back in the 40s during wartime.
Now you're building a different type of machine here.
All right.
Andrew started out in the wearable tech space and was inspired to create Ambassador when his team encountered language barriers overseas. He explains how the earphones work.
So Ambassador uses spatial filtering techniques to capture speech with high clarity at relatively far distance away. We send that speech signal to the cloud, where we then transcribe it and translate it, and then we send it back to the earphone. So effectively what happens is I speak to you in Spanish, and within maybe 1.5 seconds, you'll hear the translation directly in the earphone.
Wow, that is really fast.
Yeah, it's fast. I think once 5G rolls out, it's going to be practically instantaneous.
So that can be almost, you're saying, in real time, it can translate.
Right. So right now, the way it works, you speak and pause, speak and pause, speak and pause kind of thing. And so what we want to get to is what's known as simultaneous. So this is where you see an interpreter on TV, where the host is speaking and the interpreter is interpreting in real time right alongside them. That's the next wave of translation. Then that'll be a huge, I mean, it's going to completely revolutionize translation technology.
Okay. How long do you think that it'll take to get to that?
Honestly, I think we'll start seeing prototypes next year.
The concept sounds great, but does it actually work? I decide to try it out myself.
Here I have mobile internet, and this is why like, I'm bringing second one, just in case.
George, senior software engineer, starts by opening the app on his phone, which then connects to the ambassador earphones.
Oh, yeah.
Much better.
Yeah,
if
maybe.
You want, maybe yeah. Like
in converse mode, both George and I put one earphone over our ear, and George speaks to me in Russian.
Я надеюсь, программа переведет.
After about 2 to 3 seconds, I hear his words translated to me in English.
I hope the program translates my speech. It is doing it in real time. I'm so excited. It's actually working.
That worked well. Will ambassadors put translators out of business?
Now, we would say for sure, if you're trying to like negotiate a nuclear peace treaty, then like use a professional interpreter, okay? For sure. But there's a lot of applications where translation technology today is good enough to replace some of those interactions. Now, in the future, my prediction is in 7 to 10 years, we start achieving human parity for some languages.
And you think the technology can get that good?
Yeah, for some languages, like a lot of the Latin languages, French, Italian, Spanish, those languages are so very similar in terms of the syntactic structure of the sentences. Some of the other more worldly languages, like Russian or Hindi, Arabic especially, Chinese, Japanese is a very difficult language. They're just more complicated. The sentence structure itself is just very extremely different. That becomes an issue. But that's only part of the problem. What that means is we can translate words and phrases with high accuracy. But translating, let's say, colloquialisms and intent and emotion behind what's being spoken, that's a more difficult problem for AI to solve. You know, translating your emotion into the translations themselves. So I think we can get there maybe in 20 years, maybe even less, honestly, where it's a really fluid, really wonderful experience.
Kizzy Cox reporting. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend, you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World This Week. And Caroline Wyatt joins me now to tell me what's in the latest edition.
This week, NATO found a new challenge, China, to unite the 70-year-old alliance, despite divisions among its leaders. President Donald Trump left the London meeting early, arriving home to a different storm, confirmation that the House of Representatives will file impeachment charges against him. We'll ask why Malta's Prime Minister has promised to step down, and how a trial over the murder of a journalist in 2017 is worrying the government there. We'll also take a closer look at why some of China's citizens fear that facial recognition has gone too far. And we'll hear what the voters think, with the British general election less than a week away.
Thanks, Caroline. And that's all in The World This Week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website, www.bbc.co.uk/programmes. And still to come in this podcast, Born to be Fined. Indonesia's national airline in trouble over a smuggled motorbike. The last televised leaders' debate before Britain goes to the polls next week has seen the Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson go head-to-head with Jeremy Corbyn of the main opposition Labour Party. The two men face questions from a carefully vetted studio audience live on BBC television. Thursday's poll has been dubbed the Brexit election. This was how they made their pitches on that. Boris Johnson first.
Everybody on the Labour front bench is campaigning to remain, apart from Mr Corbyn, who is neutral on the matter. Who is going to secure this deal? How can you get a deal, a new deal from Brussels for Brexit, if you don't actually believe in it?
We will, within 3 months, negotiate a leave agreement with the European Union that will protect trade and jobs and the peace process in Northern Ireland, and put that alongside Remain in a referendum within 6 months, and that will be the end of the matter.
Jeremy Corbyn there. Our political correspondent, Rob Watson, watched the debate. So, was there a clear winner?
Absolutely not. It was a remarkably subdued and polite affair, given that the election is less than a week away. You'd have thought there was going to be some frantic scramble for votes, but there was just none of that at all.
Yeah, so the dominant theme, Brexit, Mr. Johnson tried to push the idea that Mr. Corbyn was muddled. And likewise, Mr. Corbyn said, look, we are the people who will give the British people a chance to vote on this. What appeared to be the most popular line?
OK, so here's the way, this is what I picked out of it, and that was clearly Mr. Johnson trying to do what I would call maximising the leave vote strategy. What do I mean by that? I mean, it seems to me that Mr. Johnson has taken the view, perfectly understandably, that he will win the election if most of the people who voted leave in the referendum in 2016 fall behind the Conservatives, but most Remainers are sort of split amongst all the other parties, including the Conservatives. So that's why he kept on repeating, get Brexit done, let's get Brexit done. And in fact, the most interesting moment in Brexit in the whole debate was when the presenter, Nick Robinson, said, you know, Mr. Johnson, essentially you're misleading folks because, you know, getting Brexit done, leaving in January is not quite the same as kind of spelling out what the future relationship will be, which is not what you've done. For his part, you know, Mr. Corbyn didn't want to talk about Brexit particularly. It was all about austerity. I mean, his pitch is that all of the UK's problems are to do with there not being enough government spend and that he would spend more.
Rob Watson. For almost three decades, the name Macedonia has been at the heart of a bitter dispute between Greece and its northern neighbour, now renamed the Republic of North Macedonia. That's because there's also a province in Greece called Macedonia. Courtney Bembridge and Catherine Carelli grew up knowing different sides of this story. They travelled across the region, from Thessaloniki in Greece to Skopje, the capital of North Macedonia, a year after the name change, to find out how well it's all working.
Two leaders came together to sign a document. It gave the country to the north of Greece a new name, North Macedonia. But a year on, the resentment in the region itself hasn't faded. For me, Catherine Carelli, as a Greek, this dispute is an important part of modern Greek identity.
And for me, Courtney Bembridge, an Australian with Macedonian roots, the dispute sheds light on my complicated family history. In Thessaloniki, the capital of the Greek province of Macedonia, proud Greeks have been holding rallies to say the name belongs to them.
Macedonian is Greece only.
They accuse the North Macedonians of appropriating Greek history. Michalis Patsikas is a Greek activist.
They need to know that history is not on their side. This is unfair and a lie does not create the truth. Our anger is towards the Greek politicians who time after time have sold the name of Macedonia.
Alexis Tsipras, the Greek Prime Minister who made history by signing the deal, was out of office a few months later. His replacement, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, has made no secret of his opposition to it, but he's done little in power to reverse it.
I still believe the Prespa agreement was a negative agreement for our country. I voted against it and I warned Greeks about what signing it would mean. I will not offend the coat of arms by exposing the country to unpredictability.
Across the border, in Skopje, there were also protests over the Prespa agreement. At a referendum on the issue, two-thirds of the country boycotted the vote. North Macedonia's Prime Minister Zoran Zaev put his political career on the line by agreeing to the name change. After years of Greece vetoing EU membership for his country, he hoped the deal would open the door. But the EU has yet to give North Macedonia the green light, and Zoran Zaev has had to call snap elections.
Do you feel that you've paid the price for solving a problem that everyone wanted to see solved?
It's a kind of punishment. It was a long-lasting period of time with this name issue dispute. 3 decades. And because of this issue, we lose generations.
For many younger citizens in North Macedonia, like Blažen, time is running out.
We live in the 21st century. Everything is one click away. And I think young people feel that they deserve better and they can do better in other countries. So that's why they leave.
Close to the North Macedonian border, on the Greek side, there's a group of villages where the definition of Macedonian is even more complicated.
We've come to see my great aunt, Christina Madimajotis. She grew up speaking what is now known as Macedonian, a Slavic language. When Christina was at school, Slavic-speaking children in the village were beaten if they strayed into their mother tongue. But for Greek activists like Michalis Patsikas, there's no such thing as a Macedonian.
There are no Macedonians as an identity, not even in Greece.
The question of national identity has provoked disagreement and disharmony right across Europe in recent years. In the case of the name Macedonia, it's clear that compromise will always come at a cost.
That was Catherine Corelli, and you also heard from Courtney Bembridge. Indonesia's national airline, Garuda, has been fined following allegations that its boss used a company plane to smuggle a $57,000 Harley-Davidson motorbike into the country. Here's our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow.
Harley-Davidson motorbikes, with their distinctive chopper look, are beloved the world over, not least in Indonesia, where there's currently a row over one particular red and white bike. The saga began with the inspection of a Garuda flight from France last month. The plane was brand new and had come straight from the Airbus factory in Toulouse. The flight's manifest said there was no cargo, but that wasn't true. On board, there was a classic 1970s Harley-Davidson. There were also two expensive fold-up Brompton bicycles and their accessories. The items are alleged to have belonged to the airline's CEO, Ari Askara, who'd apparently got subordinates to buy them for him and arrange their shipment. The Garuda executive is accused of trying to evade customs tax on the undeclared items and has already been sacked. Cabin crew have welcomed the removal of the CEO, who'd struggled to make the airline profitable and who was disliked for scrapping some employee allowances.
Michael Bristow. And we end this podcast with a story that should lift even the gloomiest of spirits. 5-year-old Michael Clark from the US state of Michigan has been formally adopted, and his entire kindergarten class of 20 children turned up in court to offer their support. And what's more, they were all given a chance to say why they were there. Michael had been fostered for the past year by Andrea Melvin and Dave Eaton, but they legally became his adoptive parents in a court hearing attended by his classmates, teachers and parents. Here's Dave and Michael.
No, this process has been amazing. We've been working with Catholic Charities, and the workers there have just been amazing.
I love my daddy.
Wow.
Love my daddy so much.
This is just too much.
Well, Kerry McKee is Michael's kindergarten teacher. My colleague Julian Marshall gave her a call.
Michael was on my class list as of August, and I did notice that he came with some papers indicating that he was a foster child. And so I did meet with the parents before school to see how I could be of assistance. How could we help with this transition? Because I knew that this was his first time in the schools, and we wanted to make sure that it was the smoothest transition possible. And they were very kind and very receptive. And actually, we were kind of guiding each other through this transition. We have a school theme song that we play each Friday morning and Friday at dismissal when the children leave. The song is entitled Put a Little Love in Your Heart. That song was really special, and I tried to impart on the children that the lyrics were not just words to say or to sing, that these were words that we could put into action. And when I kept in contact with Michael's foster parents, I was constantly asking, have you heard anything yet about adoption? Because they just loved him, and he just loved his foster parents as well. I saw such a connection. And I think it was October 30th that Andrea, his mom-to-be, mentioned that there may be a December 5th court date for official adoption. And I was so thrilled for her that I wanted her to make sure she told some of the other parents. I saw when she told them, I saw her just beam for the possibility of being a brand new mom. And I thought, how can we support Michael with that same feeling, that feeling of being included and supported and loved? And so I just kind of thought about what would be the chances for us to have the opportunity to go to this special event? So I asked my principal, and she said, you know, let's just think about that. Let's see what happens. I inquired with parents to see what they thought, and parents in the class overwhelmingly offered to take the day off of work, to drive their children to the courthouse, whatever they could do to make it happen. And one of those parents offered to pay for a school bus to take the children safely there, because I told her, I said, it's important for us to enter the courtroom as one.
Did you speak to Michael about this?
I did not, because I wasn't sure. I did speak to Andrea once I got permission from my principal, and of course it brought her to tears. She said, oh, I don't know why I put mascara on this morning. She said, oh, this is really going to be tough. And I said, well, I don't know if everything's going to go for sure. We have to get some logistics taken care of. When it finally went through, I emailed her. I said, you know what? You need to ask Michael if it's okay, because this was a family occasion. I refer to my children in my classroom as family. And so I said, it makes sense to me with my heart, but I said, I want Michael's opinion and approval. And he, according to his parents, had an overwhelmingly excited response of, yes, I would like my school family to be there. So we got a bus, and these children come from a walking school district. So this was a very exciting trip for 5 and 6 year olds yesterday to ride the bus for the first time.
Tell me a little bit about Michael.
Oh, he's just charismatic. He has a magnetic personality. His smile, as I'm sure you've seen in the pictures, just lights up a room. The children adore him, but they adore each other. He has been an absolute sponge of a learner. He absorbs everything around him, and such a loving child.
And his classmates had a chance to speak of the adoption hearing.
Oh, that was just so heartfelt. And this was very unexpected. The judge asked each individual in the courtroom, adults and children, to stand, state their name, and also state why they were there. It went from some very official people, and then the line came around to me, and I stood up, told my name and my title, and I burst into tears. I couldn't even finish a sentence. And yet one of my students right next to me, 5 years of age, stood up proudly and said his name and said, he's my best friend. And then the next child next stood up and said their name and said, I love him. And then the next one was, you know, I'm so happy he has a family who will love him forever. And so 21 little voices stood up so proudly. I'm sorry. It's kind of an emotional thing. And I was so proud of them that they could stand up with no rehearsal, no inkling that this was even going to occur, and be able to represent what was in their hearts at that time for that child and that new family. Each one of them spoke so clearly and so proudly that it brought everyone in the room to tears. There was not a dry eye in the house, including the judge.
Kerry McKee, the teacher of 5-year-old Michael Clark. And that's all from us for now, but there's going to be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
By listening first, strategizing second, and collaborating constantly, MetLife Investment Management takes a client-first approach to institutional investing. With expertise in public fixed income, private capital, and real estate, we are institutional, but far from typical. Learn more at MetLife.com/institutional. That's MetLife.com/institutional.